Okay, so this week the theme is going to be black holes. Having done quite a bit of mathematics, I thought for at least this lecture I would focus a little bit more on physical properties. And a black hole doesn't, although we have these wonderful, I mean, really beautiful exact solutions, I mean, I think it's astonishing that we have something that is so accurate. Normally, when we're describing physics, we have to make compromises, and we're always having some sort of approximation to describe our physical system, and then we have to look at how our real system departs from that exact mathematical model. But for black holes, that correspondence is almost perfect. Essentially because gravity is so weak that the effect of any local environment, unless it's another black hole or neutron star, is really very, very small. So how do we see them? Why are we confident now that black holes exist? Well, we can't see them directly because they don't emit, at least classically, they don't emit anything. After all, they're a black hole. However, the black hole doesn't exist in isolation. There's usually matter around it, gas, dust, or it might be part of a binary system, in which case it's either got a sort of partner which it's sort of slowly eating up, or it could be, of course, a binary black hole. So the way that we see them, there's two main pieces of observational evidence, both of which have come in the last decade. The first is, of course, black hole mergers, and there's a limit to what we can say about that on the board. Most of that is some fairly heavy numerical work, apart from the very end. However, the other observational evidence we have is the Event Horizon Telescope, which, of course, Avery Broderick, who's here at Perimeter in Waterloo, was very, very, very much involved in. And so if we think about that, about how we might image a black hole, we can't see it directly, but can we see the shadow that it casts? Then we have to start thinking about two things. First of all, what is happening in the environment of the black hole? If we have an accretion disk, for example, how do we determine that accretion disk? And so that's all about orbits or trajectories. And then if we're talking about what we see, we have to think about the light that comes from the vicinity of the black hole. And again, that's also about trajectories, only that time it's a photon, so it's null. So in other words, in order to see black holes or evidence of black holes, what we have to do is solve geodesics. So today is going to be mostly about the geodesic equation. Now, that ought to be very familiar to you. So we have our geodesic equation, which I will affinely parameterize. So for a massive object, this would be proper time. So the geodesic equation, when you write it down like that, it's a set of four coupled nonlinear differential equations. And so as such, if you just wrote down those set of equations, it would look rather intimidating. But we rarely solve that fully coupled second order ODEs. So we find ways of simplifying, just like we do when we solve Einstein's equations. So if k mu is a Killing vector, then if I consider the contraction or the dot product, if you like, of the Killing vector with the tangent vector. This is just x dot mu grad nu of k mu x dot mu. Well, by the geodesic equation, when this x dot grad hits x dot, it gives me zero. So this is just x nu x mu grad mu k nu. And because these two objects are the same, that effectively symmetrizes, which is then zero from the Killing equation. So what this tells you is that the projection of the tangent vector on a Killing vector is conserved along the geodesic. So now that you start to build up or see that you've got conserved quantities, you can see that that's going to make your life a lot easier in terms of solving the geodesic equation. So let's look at Schwarzschild. So d by dt is a Killing vector. Therefore, if I take the t component of my tangent vector, that has to remain constant along the geodesic. So I call it E because that sort of, it suggests it's something to do with the energy of the particle. And for the d by d phi Killing vector, I see that r squared phi dot is a constant. And again, we sort of, that makes sense. It's like angular momentum. So given that our space-time is rotationally symmetric, I wouldn't expect an object moving in it to get any sort of angular kick or torque. So it makes sense that that is conserved. Then again, keeping with Schwarzschild, if I look at the theta equation, I see that the second derivative, this has to be zero, theta double dot is proportional to sine theta cos theta phi dot squared and has a theta dot term. So if my initial conditions are that theta dot is zero and theta is pi on 2, then theta double dot remains zero, and therefore theta remains pi on 2. So that, again, gives us more information or simplification, because what that tells me is if a geodesic is initially moving in the equatorial plane of the black hole, and actually we can make any plane an equatorial plane of the Schwarzschild black hole, then it remains in that plane. So geodesics are planar in the Schwarzschild background.
Say line.
So we've already simplified to quite a degree. Our theta equation we've thrown out, so that only leaves three. Our t equation, we can just say, well, hang on, I know t dot times f is a constant, so if I find my radial coordinate for the geodesic, I can just integrate that up to find my t of tau. Similarly with phi. So in fact, we've gotten rid of all but, so far, all but one second order equation, which is that of r. And now I'm going to get rid of that one. So finally, I notice that if I take a look at the length of the tangent vector, that is actually conserved along the geodesic because the length of the tangent vector is just g x dot x dot. G is covariantly constant and x dot dot grad or t dot grad of t vanishes by the geodesic equation. Therefore, this is a conserved quantity along the geodesic. So now, I don't have to look at the r equation either, because I can just say that I get r dot squared from that. So if I look at what that means, I've got t dot squared f minus r dot squared on f minus r squared phi dot squared. Remember, we're in that equatorial plane, and that equals eta, where eta is 1 or 0 for time-like or null. But I can replace my t dot with e, I can replace my phi dot with h, and this can be rewritten. So all I do is rearrange this. This t dot squared f becomes e squared on f. This becomes h squared on r squared. I multiply through by f, and I end up with this. And so what's nice about this is that you can conclude an awful lot about the possibility of geodesics without actually having to solve them. If you need to answer a specific question, sure, you'll have to solve them, but you can say a lot about what types of orbits are possible. So let's first of all look at eta equals 1. So these are massive geodesics. So if I look now at, let's say, v plus e squared minus 1, so let's just absorb that constant and let's just look at what's going on here. So we start off at infinity. If I look at these last three terms, we start off at infinity with minus something over r. So we start off with the curve going downwards. But then as r gets smaller, this term starts to kick in and it's positive. So we turn over and start to get a positive value. And then this increases until the 1 on r cubed term becomes important. And we end up, as r goes to 0, with that potential becoming negative. So that's just a sketch. But now you see that because r dot squared is equal to e squared minus 1 plus this curve, your e squared minus 1 just sort of gives you a zero of the r dot squared. So we could have, if I label some things here, this, I'm going to say this is level 01. Say there's this one, 02. Call that 03. 04. 05. So you can see there are these qualitatively different levels. So remember, r dot squared is equal to e squared minus 1 minus bf. So in essence, what you're saying is, if you look at this plot here, this is telling you something about the value of r dot squared. For example, if e squared is 1, then r dot squared is just minus v effective. So you can only have a real r dot when the potential is negative. So that's telling you that this lives somewhere over here. So if I just look before going into describing those five different possibilities, if I look at what this orbit is doing, this is the GR term. So this is like centrifugal repulsion, which is Newtonian. And this is like a Newtonian attraction. So the first two terms of this you would get if you were doing Newtonian orbits. So here, if you like, this region is exclusively GR, whereas this region here is more like Newtonian gravity. Okay, so without necessarily solving anything, let me just say what different orbits we've got. O1. So this is where the only value at which r dot can, you know, which you've got a solution is r dot equals zero. So you've kind of chosen the level of e squared minus 1 to precisely match with that minimum. So at O1, you've got V equals V primed equals zero, with V double prime positive. So these are the two constraints that you get. So at this turning point, so this is V primed here. If I solve this, this is just a quadratic for R, I get two roots. So you see that in general, you've got these two roots, one of which corresponds to the minimum and the other of which is going to correspond to the maximum. So this O1 at the minimum is obviously the plus root, because we see from the sketch that coming in from infinity, we hit the minimum first. So again, we don't have to do any fancy analysis. We just see it from sketching what's going on. So this is a circular orbit. Because r dot is zero, but h is non-zero, so the thing is going around the black hole. So then we look at O2. Now, for O2, we've got that V is now just a bit negative, so our visualization here is that our orbital motion is the same as the motion of a particle in this potential. So for O2, we're kind of oscillating between these two values of R. So we have two turning points of the motion, and there are different values of R. So if you then lift that up and think of something going round the object, that sort of has that interpretation of where you get closer to the black hole and you go further from the black hole. O3 has R in some sort of minimum. I'll just put some labels on that. Let's call this R3 and that R4. So O3 has R sort of essentially unbounded, but with a minimum, which is R3. And this is a parabolic trajectory, because the particle starts off with zero velocity at infinity. It comes in, it gets to some distance of closest approach, and then goes back out to infinity, but again, gradually slowing down such that when it eventually gets there, which actually takes an infinite amount of time, it is moving at zero velocity. For O4, we also have a similar scattering orbit, but this time the particle has finite velocity at infinity, and so that's a hyperbolic orbit. And I'm calling these parabolic, hyperbolic, circular, and elliptical, because in Newtonian gravity, orbits are, these would be the four possibilities. And in Newtonian gravity, you find that your orbits are conic sections. The equation of motion gives you a conic section. And that was how Newton explained Kepler's observations. So Kepler had done a lot of careful observations of the motion of planets around the suns and noticed they moved on exact ellipses, equal areas and equal time, so on and so forth. And those are the properties of a conic section. And what's new for GR is the plunge, where the energy is so low, if you like, that the object just goes all the way down to R equals zero. So in other words, it is captured by the black hole. So without actually solving the geodesic equation, we've found what sort of orbits are possible. We've seen that some of them occur in Newtonian gravity. But there's a new one. In other words, eventually, if your particle either sort of is too much directed at the black hole, doesn't have enough angular momentum, essentially, it's going to get captured and swallowed up by the black hole. The other thing, given that you are perturbing the Newtonian orbit graph here, you also suspect that your geodesics will be not quite conic sections. So let's look a bit more closely at these bound orbits. And first of all, just think about this maximum and minimum here. So as we change the angular momentum, that will either move those further apart or together. So you can see that as I drop the angular momentum relative to the Schwarzschild radius or the mass of the black hole, eventually this square root will hit zero. And then I can't drop angular momentum any further and still have one of these maxima or minima.
Ruth?
Mm-hmm.
So if I don't have angular momentum, I still fall on the Earth as well, right?
You still?
I still fall on the Earth with Newtonian gravity as well, right? If I don't have angular momentum. So why the plunge is different for GR? So if I don't have angular momentum,
right.
Newtonian gravity.
Right, but then that is a set of measure zero in the sense of you've got to have precisely zero angular momentum. If you have just even infinitesimal angular momentum, you will not go to R equals zero, yeah?
Okay.
You're right. There's a special case, which is a completely radial trajectory, which is obviously the same for each.
Yeah.
And again, in reality, if you're looking, you know, in Newtonian gravity, you'd be looking at a star. So, you know, actually, yes, there would be a range of angular momentum where it goes into the star. But then, you know, that would be where this equation would cease to hold because you would have hit the star. Yep. I mean, technically, we shouldn't be following this past 2GM anyway. So the reason for thinking about bound orbits is because for the accretion disk, this is going to be, you know, a whole load of matter that's swirling around the black hole. So it is going to be following some form of geodesic, at least to leading order. So so here, they merge at h squared is 12 g squared m squared. And at the point at which they merge, h squared is also 2gmr. So this tells us that that critical point at which these circular orbits disappear is 6GM. So nothing can orbit stably, at least, closer to the Schwarzschild black hole than 6GM. Thank you. So this is quite an important property or feature of the black hole. It's called the innermost stable circular orbit, or the ISCO, and that kind of represents the inner boundary of an accretion disk. So when it gets to that 6 GM, it's not really stable because it's only marginally stable, but any small kick on matter orbiting at 6 GM, if it kicks to slightly lower R, the matter will then be absorbed by the black hole. So that's really where most of the action happens from the perspective of the accretion disk, because, you know, right that close in, that's when all the particles have sort of got the most jostling and the most kinetic energy, and therefore it's the brightest part of the disk. So now let's think about what happens to any light that's emitted by the disk. So we move to eta equals zero and think about what happens to our GD6 of light. So because now we have a null geodesic, the length of the tangent vector doesn't have any real physical meaning because time doesn't move for a null particle. So I can rescale E to make it one by just rescaling my affine parameter. And then my effective potential is very simple. So this is V. Well, actually, let me make it V plus 1. It's easier. Okay, V plus 1. So V plus 1 starts out at 0 at infinity, but this time, instead of dropping down, it goes up. So that's the positive h squared term. And then because of this minus 1 and r cubed term, it's going to have to turn over and become negatively infinite. So that is our rough plot. And you see that where the point at which it crosses the axis here is 2 GM. So that's at the horizon of the black hole. So again, let's look at that turning point. So V primed So the turning point always happens at 3 GM, irrespective of the angular momentum of the photon. So this is always 3 GM. Okay, so what's the consequence of that? We might want to say, well, can we set up an orbit? So let's calculate V of 3 GM. So I find that the second and third term of V all have that behavior of h squared over g squared m squared, and they add up to h squared over 27 g squared m squared. So if h squared is 27 g squared m squared, then r dot equals zero. So what that means is we have a circular orbit. but it's unstable. And so this again is called a photon ring. And your photon ring is a sort of very characteristic feature of the black hole. So in essence, you can imagine light can spend a long time near this 3GM before it actually either escapes or gets absorbed. So let's just look more generally. And you may have seen this if you were looking at solar system tests. If you have U as 1 over R, du by d phi, which is U dot on phi dot, so du d phi is just R dot on H, so therefore my geodesic equation actually takes a nicer form. So just going back to that question before about the radial plunge and for both Newtonian and Einstein, here in order to do this, you're very much looking at something that isn't a radial trajectory. And so here, this is where you see the conic section, because Newtonian gravity wouldn't have that last term. And then you can kind of rearrange this into something that has the conic section as a solution. I'm just aware, I don't know if it's because it's Monday morning or whether I'm also sort of slightly befuddled, but there's not many questions. Everybody's very quiet. So, am I going too fast? Is it all, you've done some of it before? Is it sort of okay? Or is it Monday morning? Okay. So you might have seen this if you were doing solar system tests, because you kind of approximate an orbit by being circular. And so then that tells you U isn't changing much, and you sort of do a perturbation analysis on this. But what I'm interested in doing is talking about light and the photons coming from a black hole. So if I set eta equals zero here, du by d phi, and of course E is one on H squared. I think there should be an eta here. That should have had an eta, yeah. So for my light, I've got a relatively simple differential equation. But of course, how do you find the angular momentum? And that again comes back to thinking about, you know, where you start your trajectory off. So to find H, you first of all just think about straight lines in sort of flat space, because as you go off to infinity, space becomes flat. So a straight line in flat space would have a trajectory, for example. X is R cos phi is equal to B, where B is called, it is known as the impact parameter. So it's just really saying, how far away are you starting that object? How sort of how much are you making it miss the black hole? So if I look at rewriting this, this tells me that BU is cos phi, and therefore du d phi is then equal to minus sine phi over B. But du d phi has to satisfy that equation over there. So as u goes to zero, if I look over there, my u prime squared plus u squared is 1 on h squared from my geodesic equation. So that's the dominant term. And here, my du d phi is 1 over, is sine squared phi over b squared plus u squared, which is cos squared phi over b squared. And so I see that h is just b. So that gives me an interpretation of that parameter h. We know it's related to angular momentum, and we've related the angular momentum to the impact parameter. So now let's think about what happens as I fire, I'm thinking at the moment just of firing light at the black hole. So I would imagine if I sort of look well away from the black hole, the light may be bent, but it's going to head off to infinity. If I fire it too close to the black hole, it's going to get captured. And so the question of whether the light is captured or not is related to whether there is a minimum value of R or a maximum value of U. So that would be, it's a cubic equation for u, but let me, rather than trying to solve the cubic, just think about this object here, u squared minus 2gmu cubed. So if I just sort of ask, when is that as big as it could possibly be in magnitude, that's going to occur at u equals 1 over 3 gm when u squared minus 2 gm u cubed is equal to 1 over 27 g squared m squared. So you see that same value coming up again. So So if I make my B too small, and again, that corresponds with this notion of gradually aiming the photon closer and closer to the black hole, this gives me my critical impact parameter below which light is always captured. And so you get this picture where light further away gets sort of bent round and then gradually sort of starts to go round until finally there's this region here where the light is always captured. Okay, so that's just talking a little bit about at least some of the machinery that you need if you're going to look for black hole shadows or try to describe a black hole shadow, or also to try and describe what the vicinity of the black hole looks like, because you see these artists' renditions of a black hole as sort of this thing which has, you know, all this mass swirling in, and that's not what you see, because here you see the light going round and round, so you actually see behind the black hole, and so your images are extremely distorted. So that was captured very nicely in the movie Interstellar. So just to finish off, I want to say a bit about what happens when you have rotation, because in reality, objects in astrophysics rotate, and so black holes will rotate. So the Kerr solution represents a rotating black hole. It's a solution to the vacuum Einstein equations. It's written there in Boyer-Lindquist coordinates. The parameter A is what's telling you about the rotation, and it is the angular momentum of the black hole divided by the mass parameter. And you see the rotation because of that cross term T phi, which is proportional to A. So there are a couple of things to notice about the Kerr solution, and that is that when sigma minus 2mr equals zero, which is when some at the critical value r is gm plus or minus, but we want the plus, so at this point, GTT is zero, which implies that d by dt squared becomes zero. So what that means is that if you are a massive particle, you cannot remain at rest relative to infinity. If you were at rest relative to infinity, you would just have your r, theta, and phi being constant, and your tangent vector would be d by dt. So if d by dt is negative, that's impossible. You've got to have a positive tangent vector length. So it's impossible to remain at rest And so this region is called the ergosphere. Because you've got to move once you're inside there. So what happens to all of this machinery that I was talking about with geodesics? Because we still have killing vectors. D by dt is still a killing vector, and d by d phi is still a killing vector. So you still get conserved quantities, which are sort of like energy and sort of like angular momentum, but now they're all sort of muddled and mixed up. So if I take, I'm just going to define P alpha so I'm just going to look now at the T phi subspace. Then I can find P alpha, P beta, G alpha beta is equal to G alpha beta x dot alpha x dot beta. So the reason I'm doing this is because I want to look at the that conserved quantity eta. So if I calculate that, this here, what I get is e squared g inverse tt minus 2eh g t phi plus h squared g phi phi. So I find my inverse Kerr metric. I'll give you the intermediate step. Okay, so now remember that our expression, our conserved quantity along the geodesic was x dot mu, x dot nu, g mu nu. So if I define now p mu is g mu nu x dot nu, just like I did for the angular components, then I get eta, or m squared. I get this complete expression. But notice that there's this common sigma running throughout on the denominator. And remember, sigma was r squared plus a squared cos squared theta. So if I multiply through my equation by sigma, I've got a function of r plus a function of theta. And on the right-hand side, through all this lot, this is a function of r now. This is a function of theta. That's p theta, and that's pr. So what this tells me is that the geodesic equation is separable. So I can end up finding my PR and P theta just by integrating up with respect to adding in this integration constant, and this is known as the Carter constant up to A minus H. You sometimes add an additional constant to the Carter constant. And so what this means is actually that geodesics in Kerr are now almost as easy to find as in Schwarzschild, because you still have a lot of conserved quantities. So here, this Carter constant sort of allows you to implicitly integrate up. And so that means this is the so-called Hamilton-Jacobi approach, where you've got a potential for your geodesic S of r, theta, phi, and t, such that these p mu's is equal to ds by dx mu. And so your geodesics are much easier to find.